the House has voted to proceed with the formal impeachment of President Trump. Today's decision was fueled by experts from the National Security Council breaking away from the president.
Donald Trump is a very irregular president, and the NSC is probably the place where the collision between his irregularities and the regular way of doing government was probably the most violent.
Also, former National Security Advisor Susan Rice weighs in.
He seems to be utilizing the office to advance his personal political interests, and that's what's so striking.
Still don't have your Halloween costume picked out? It's all good. We've got some ideas from Tokyo, like this one. Come as the guy who forgot to take out the trash. And just to be clear, I'm not joking. I'm Carol Hills. Those stories ahead on The World. The House of Representatives voted today to proceed with the formal impeachment inquiry of President Donald Trump.
On this vote, the yeas are 232, the nays are 196. The resolution is adopted without objection. The motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
And so, with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's gavel, we enter a new phase of the impeachment process. Meanwhile, today, in lower levels of the Capitol building, investigators were hearing from Tim Morrison. He's the top Russia official on President Trump's National Security Council. He plans to leave his post. Today, Morrison reinforced a lot of what we've heard from others, that President Trump threatened to withhold aid money to Ukraine until it agreed to investigate the Biden family. John Gans sees some irony in Morrison testifying. Gans is a former Pentagon speechwriter and the author of White House Warriors: How the National Security Council Transformed the American Way of War. He says Morrison is known as a hawk on Russia and is a protege of former National Security Advisor John Bolton.
He's so hawkish that when he joined the NSC, everybody sort of wondered if he would start a war. And instead, he's leaving with a story to tell that I think a lot of people in the so-called resistance, and certainly those who are working on the Democratic-led inquiry into the Ukraine scandal, are hoping will be helpful to their cause. I think that is probably wishful thinking. I mean, I think that Morrison certainly sounds as though he was concerned with the policy at play. But one of the things that John Bolton and to some extent Tim Morrison are known for is their belief that the president sets the course. And this impeachment hearing is shaping up to be at least a fight over Congress's ability to hold presidents account for foreign policy decisions. It will remain to be seen how helpful he is and to a degree whether he is a harbinger for John Bolton getting involved as well.
The House Intelligence Committee issued a subpoena this morning for Morrison's testimony. The White House directed him not to appear. Did he want to testify?
I haven't spoken to him about it, so it's hard to say. My hunch is that I don't think anybody wants to be a part of this more than they have to be. Most of these staffers like Tim Morrison and most of those who served on the staff, and I wrote a book on 70 years of the staff from Truman, really, Harry Truman to President Trump. Most of them don't really seek the spotlight. They don't want to really end up in the newspapers. They're there to serve the president. They're there to serve the nation's interests. And so this is a testament to how irregular things have gotten, that people like Tim Morrison are the subject of interviews like this or walking up to Congress to testify. National security staffers aren't supposed to testify to Congress. They're not supposed to go to the Hill and open up about what the president was deciding. That is the tradition, and to a degree, that's by design. So the president has the staff that he needs to do his job. So I don't think anybody wants to be a part of this. It's more high profile than people want. It's certainly more costly. People like Tim Morrison make probably, you know, $100,000+ a year, and right now they're paying very expensive lawyers to try and help them navigate this treacherous place. And the scandal itself is a place where their reputations could be damaged. They could get blamed for things. They could be held culpable for things. So I don't think anybody wants to be a part of this, but it sort of is a reminder of how irregular Washington has gotten and how unconventional President Trump has made the making of foreign policy.
Now, you've been talking about how the NSC works. What's different about this bureaucracy that might make it tricky to ever get to the bottom of just what went on in terms of a possible Ukraine quid pro quo?
Absolutely. Well, the reason it will be difficult to get to the bottom of it is twofold. One, it does seem as though this was done outside of the regular channels. So how many notes were kept? Who had a bigger role, Rudy Giuliani or, you know, whoever these outsiders who are involved in? So there's a piece of it that's just irregular. The other piece of it is that the NSC staff is considered staff to the president. And as part of that is part of the White House the executive office of the president, and that is generally shielded from congressional inquiry by executive privilege. And so generally speaking, these staffers are not expected to testify. They're not really allowed to testify. The National Security Advisor is a very powerful position but is not confirmed by the U.S. Senate. And that is a status that has been accepted by Republicans and Democrats and is probably one of the reasons John Bolton got the job. And so what you end up in a situation is that getting to the staff and getting to know what the staff thinks is very difficult to do. I had to work very hard to do it, to write a book about them. And so typically speaking, they would never talk to Congress about what the president said and what he did behind the scenes because that's shielded as part of staff work and executive privilege. The White House has struggled to assert executive privilege in this situation, in part because they released the testimony of the Ukraine call themselves, but also because it seems as though it was so irregular and so upsetting to people that people are willing to stand up and defy the president, as it's clear Tim Morrison is doing today with his decision to testify.
John Ganz is a former Pentagon speechwriter and the author of White House Warriors, a book about the National Security Council. Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Later in the show, where does one of President Obama's former national security advisors think the impeachment inquiry is heading? Susan Rice has a new memoir out and came into our studio. We're talking impeachment, the U.S. withdrawal from northern Syria, and the enduring legacy of Benghazi that continues to dog her. That's ahead this hour. This was Baghdad last night, and yes, it's part party, part protest. Iraqis have been protesting since early October. Hundreds of men and women have shown up on the streets, defying curfews, tear gas, and even snipers. And today, there's a new development. The world's Shirin Jafari is here to tell us more.
Hey, Carol. Yep, today, Iraqi President Barham Saleh went on national television and made an announcement.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ikhwati wa akhawati.
Saleh said that the Prime Minister, Adel Abdul Mahdi, has agreed to step down. He said his government will hold an early election and that it's going to be overseen by an independent election commission.
So how are protesters reacting to that news?
From what I've seen so far, they are not satisfied, Carol. They say these changes don't address their grievances, which are mainly about unemployment, government corruption, and lack of basic services. They say his speech is just an example of how out of touch he is with the protesters on the streets.
So put these protests in context for us. Kind of what's going on here and how did we get to this point?
Okay, here's a very simplified version of how we got here. It's been 16 years since the U.S. invaded Iraq, right? The occupation brought down Saddam Hussein, who was one of the region's most feared dictators. After a few years of bloodshed, the U.S. decided to pull most of its troops out of Iraq. That was back in 2011. And with the withdrawal came a vacuum. Iraq at the time was still very fragile, and some experts say that it was this vacuum that gave rise to groups like the Islamic State. The Islamic State went on to brutalize not only the Iraqis, but also Syrians.
So what happened after the Islamic State gained power in terms of Iraq?
Well, Iraq couldn't fight the group by its own. The U.S. sent some forces back to help train and support Iraqi forces. And it was with their help that they managed to defeat ISIS.
So is this the end of ISIS's influence in Iraq?
No. In fact, just today, the official media channel for the group announced that they have a new leader. His name is Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qureshi. There's not much that we know about him other than that he claims to be a descendant of Prophet Muhammad. That is important because in the Islamic State, they believe that only a direct descendant of the Prophet can rule the group and maybe even the caliphate if they have one later on.
Okay, so getting back to these protests, why is it that we should think about the U.S. pullout and ISIS when we're discussing these protests going on in Iraq today?
Because the vacuum that the U.S. pullout left in Iraq in 2011 also gave rise to another powerful force, Iran. Iran is right next door to Iraq, and with the U.S. gone, Iran gained a lot of influence in Iraq.
And are the protesters talking about Iran's influence?
Absolutely. They say they're tired of Iran meddling in Iraqi politics. And all of this, they say, has not made their lives any easier. I mean, Iraq is a rich country, Carol. It has a lot of oil. But for many young Iraqis, they're not able to find jobs. And protesters say there's a lot of corruption within the government.
So other than what the Iraqi president said today, how has the government responded to these protests?
Even though the protesters have been mostly peaceful, in some instances, the security forces have responded with force. Amnesty International put out a report today, and they documented at least 250 deaths. I asked their Iraq researcher, Raza Al-Salihi, if she sees any differences between what we see today and previous protests in Iraq.
What we have seen this year is not unsimilar, but on a much larger scale and much more brazen, including a campaign of intimidation against activists and journalists, disappearing activists. Some activists remain disappeared to date. Other than that, what we did not see last year is the brazen use of cars to try and run over protesters. We have seen this in the city of Karbala and in Basra.
So as you can hear, Carol, there's a lot of brutality going on in Iraq, and the government is trying to put an end to these protests both through force and various promises that it's been making. But it's really hard to imagine that these protests will die down anytime soon.
The world's Shireen Jafari. Thanks for the update.
You're welcome, Carol.
Now to Australia, where backpackers go to surf, sightsee, hike, and pay taxes. Since 2017, backpackers on working holiday visas have been taxed an extra 15%. No longer. This week, a court in Australia declared its backpacker tax to be illegal. The world's Bianca Hillier has more.
In Australia, backpacking is a little different than your typical post-college European trip. Backpackers in Australia usually stay for 1 or 2 years. To do that, you need a visa, and you have to work for part of that time. Aaron Abraham from England was fine with that arrangement.
Just moving some bulls.
He went to a farm under a working holiday visa, didn't make a ton of money, and he said the 15% backpacker tax wasn't part of his plan.
People are living day by day. They're scraping by when they're working on a farm.
Crystal Fox from London spent 2 years in Australia on a working holiday visa. She, too, was blindsided by the tax.
I didn't know that until I started working. And then you kind of just see this big amount of money being taken.
But a ruling this week is being called a win for the poor backpacker. An Australian federal judge said the backpacker tax was a disguised form of discrimination based on nationality. Abraham agrees.
We're all meant to be there working equally with equal rights. And if we're paying a different tax and working lower level jobs, there's discrimination there is quite evident.
Australian farmers also didn't like the tax. They rely on backpackers to pick produce. Emma Germano is a vegetable grower and board member of the Victorian Farmers Federation.
We were saying, don't tax these people more. We don't want to see them taxed. We struggle to get people on farms as it is.
She was talking to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation there. Joel Fitzgibbon, a politician with an opposition party in Australia, said the tax never should have been introduced in the first place.
The government introduced this revenue grab without any consultation with industry stakeholders and, of course, without any country-to-country consultation.
Backpacker Crystal Fox said she would have used the extra 15% to travel more.
If I had got that extra 15%, it would have allowed me to see some more places and kind of stay in those places for longer because traveling Australia is really, really expensive.
With this week's ruling outlawing the backpacker tax, there's also a refund. Crystal Fox, Aaron Abraham, and up to 80,000 other backpackers in Australia could get around $2,000 back.
I would be pretty happy to get anything back because I didn't think that we'd ever get anything back from that, to be honest.
Hopefully I do get some money back, and if not, it's not the end of the world.
The Australian Taxation Office is considering an appeal. Still, even if the tax does come back, Crystal Fox says the Australian experience would be worth it.
I would highly recommend it, despite this tax problem, to be honest. I feel like that was just kind of like a minor thing to the overall experience of Australia.
Aussie, Aussie, Aussie.
Fight, fight, fight!
For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. 2019 is the year of the pig in the Chinese zodiac. There's some tragic irony in that. African swine fever has killed millions of pigs in China this year. Now the disease is spreading across Asia. South Korea is deploying snipers and drones, yes, drones, to kill wild boars. Sound extreme? Food safety experts say African swine fever could pose a big threat to the world's food supply. Pork prices are already rising. Here to explain is Dr. Wantani Kalpraweet in Bangkok. She's the head of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization's emergency work on animal diseases in Asia. Dr. Kalpraweet, why is the African swine fever such a big threat?
This African swine fever is a viral disease that can affect domestic pigs and also wild boar. And it can cause up to 100% case fatality. And because this virus is quite stable, it can survive in a long time. If the wild boar die of this disease, the carcasses, even though it's rotten, it still carries the virus and pass on to the domestic pigs. The disease can come in from so many means, including people. Human being can carry the virus from our clothes, from our body, external surface. Flies can also be one of the means of virus transmission. So it is challenging in terms of the biosecurity.
And just to be clear, the African swine fever is something that can be spread among animals, but not to humans. Is that correct?
Correct. There is no public health threat.
Now, already South Korean pig farmers have had to euthanize many of their pigs. Isn't that correct?
Yes, because we do not have the effective vaccine or the effective treatment yet. So the recommendation, if the disease gets into the country, is slaughtering the infected pigs in order to contain the outbreaks.
Is the use of snipers and drones, is this a first in terms of focusing on animals carrying disease, or has this been used before?
I believe hunting of the infected wild boar is practiced in Europe. Using sniper and drone, especially drone, is a new technology that the Republic of Korea applied. But the principle is to hunt the infected wild boar.
I know China is a country that's been enormously affected. How many pigs have had to be slaughtered or euthanized in China because of the African swine fever outbreak?
The official figure from China is about 2 million. And I just have to say that this is official figure. And in this case, the number of pigs may be more than the official figure being reported to international community.
Wow. So it may be even many more pigs. China is a huge consumer of pork, and I understand that it's now importing a lot of pork because its local production is down. How serious is this African swine fever in terms of the overall pig population?
China is the number one pig production country. Vietnam is the number five. From Vietnam alone, the figure that they report is almost 6 million pigs. For China, even though the formal figure is only 2 million, we believe that the production of pigs has been going down up to 50%. So in this case, the pig supply would be reduced by half from Asia. And we have seen already that pork price have been increased. And this would have the impact on the food security for sure.
At this point, how many countries around the world have been affected by the African swine fever?
Well, the majority of the countries in Africa, several countries in Eastern Europe, and in Asia alone, 10 countries reported the disease.
Is there any hope of a vaccine?
Several groups of scientists are saying that it is promising, but it has to go through experiment in the field before it can be commercially available. It would be at least about 2 years. That's what scientists estimate.
Dr. Wantani Kalpraweet is the UN's Emergency Animal Diseases Specialist. She's based in Bangkok. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
October 31st, Halloween, and the hard deadline for the United Kingdom to finally leave the European Union. Or not. Deadline, schmedline. But it is the last day on the job for John Bercow, the Speaker of the House of Commons. His booming baritone has been the audible symbol of Britain's Parliament for 10 years. As the BBC's Sean Curran reports, when Bercow first got his job, his voice was a shadow of what it's become.
Order, order.
He'd probably been practicing in private for years, but that was the first time John Bercow called order in the House of Commons. MPs had just taken part in the first open election for a speaker.
I thank you from the bottom of my heart for the confidence that you have placed in me.
On that night in June 2009, Parliament's reputation was firmly in the doldrums following the expenses scandal. John Bercow offered himself as a clean break candidate. He was the youngest speaker in almost 200 years, something he said had lost him the vote of at least one senior Tory.
I asked if he'd back me today. Certainly not, Bercow. You're not just too young, you're far too young. Given that in my judgment, the speaker ought to be virtually senile.
That showmanship, simply showing off to his critics, was on display again just a few days ago when John Bercow imitated the late Tony Benn.
As somebody, a very long-serving member of this House, once said, sadly no longer with us, it's not about policies, it's about policies, it's not about personalities. It's not about personalities, it's about policies.
The Speaker had just ruled that Boris Johnson couldn't hold a meaningful vote on his Brexit deal. This led to the now regular accusations of bias that have dogged John Bercow for years. The Speaker has won a worldwide television and social media audience for his flowery language and his put-downs of MPs and ministers. Here he is, ticking off the Cabinet Office Minister, Michael Gove.
Don't gesticulate, don't rant, spare us the theatrics, behave yourself, be a good boy, young man, be a good boy.
Last year, John Bercow faced allegations of bullying, accusations he has strenuously denied. He faced calls to apologise after he was reported to have used the phrase stupid woman following a row with Andrea Leadsom about a government statement. John Bercow's reputation is a result of both his personality and his approach to parliamentary procedure. He promised to change the Commons.
Order, urgent question.
Urgent questions and emergency debates that were once as rare as snow in August are now a regular, almost daily feature. The question MPs will have to answer next week when they elect the 158th Speaker is what's next for the House of Commons.
The BBC's Sean Curran reporting from London. News headlines are coming at you next. This is The World. It's said that victors write the history books, and sometimes they portray it incorrectly.
He was a wonderful archaeologist, but he was not a forward-thinking man on social issues at all. So he brings his own racial biases, causes him to completely misinterpret the site.
Now museums are correcting the archaeological history of the Nubian kingdoms in modern Sudan. That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. Republicans are standing behind President Trump.
Democrats are trying to impeach the president because they are scared they cannot defeat him at the ballot box.
That's House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy speaking today. Moments later, the House voted to proceed with formal impeachment proceedings. The Democratic push has been driven by testimonies of national security officials. Susan Rice was one of President Obama's national security advisors. She has a new memoir out called Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. She visited our studio, and I asked her where she thought the impeachment process was headed.
It's an extraordinary circumstance, unlike any other we've had in our history, where we may face articles of impeachment drawn up to rebuke the conduct of a president in foreign policy, where it appears, with mounting evidence, that the president has abused the office by trying to extort negative information, false and negative information, on his perceived political opponent, Joe Biden, from a foreign government by holding back military assistance that was badly needed and a White House visit the extraordinary thing about this, Carol, is that rather than working to advance U.S. national security interests, as any president of both parties in previous administrations would be doing, he seems to be utilizing the office to advance his personal political interests. And that's what's so striking.
Now, another topic that gets a lot of discussion is Vice President Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden. He was working for a Ukrainian gas company, Burisma, in 2014. He was serving on their board. And that was around the same time his father, Joe Biden, was playing a key role in relations with Ukraine for the Obama White House. That raises some questions about the appropriate role of family members in government. Would you have stood by if one of your adult children, let's pretend they're adults and out there, wanted to do the same thing?
Well, I don't want to speak in hypotheticals, but I think Hunter Biden has said that in retrospect, he wishes he had done differently. Having said that, I can tell you that Joe Biden's role was purely in service of U.S. policy on behalf of President Obama. He was not doing business to serve his son or his own personal interests, in contrast to what we've seen apparently with President Trump.
He was pushing, the optics of it are pretty strong.
I think, look,
nevertheless, I mean, Hunter Biden wouldn't have been asked to be on the board if his father hadn't been Joe Biden.
Well, I don't know the circumstances of why he was asked to be on the board and why he accepted. I do know that it was perfectly public and transparent at the time. There was nothing obscured about it, and the questions were asked and answered in that moment. But I also think that it's fair to acknowledge Hunter's own statements in retrospect. But the important issue here is whether or not that U.S. policy was compromised to serve a personal interest. There's absolutely no evidence of that. And I can state, as somebody who was involved in the policymaking at that point, that what Vice President Biden was doing was pursuing the United States, Western countries, and the international financial institutions' anti-corruption agenda.
I want to shift gears to your memoir, Tough Love. After reading it, I feel like it could just as easily have been called Don't Take Any Crap From Anyone, something your father used to tell you.
It could have been titled that. You're right. Don't Take Crap Off Anyone would have been another alternative formulation.
What sort of impact did your father's advice have on you?
Well, my father was an extraordinary man. He was born in segregated South Carolina around 1920, faced the harshest form of Jim Crow, served at Tuskegee during World War II with the Tuskegee Airmen at a time when it was believed that blacks couldn't effectively fight or fly. And he served in a segregated military, as some will recall, when the mission was to fight for the freedom of everybody in this country and around the world except for African Americans. And so my father, who was an extraordinary patriot and served in our government at the highest levels, ultimately as a governor of the Federal Reserve, also was quite affected by the experience of serving in a segregated military and the message that it sent about how this country viewed people like him and like me. And he had several sayings, one of which was, if my being black is going to be a problem, it's going to be a problem for somebody else, not for me. In other words, I'm not going to allow other people's bigotry, which is born of insecurity, become my own insecurity. And in the same vein, he taught me and my brother often, don't take crap off of anybody. If anybody's trying to discount you or dismiss you or cause you to doubt yourself, you push back.
We're talking to former National Security Advisor and U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Susan Rice. Her new memoir is called Tough Love. Ambassador Rice, you talk in detail in your book about the 2012 Benghazi attacks, when you appeared on multiple Sunday shows, against your mother's advice, I should say, to say that the evidence at hand suggested the attacks weren't pre-planned but were a spontaneous response.
What our assessment is as of the present is, in fact, what it began spontaneously in Benghazi as a reaction to what had transpired some hours earlier in Cairo.
That, of course, came back to haunt you. Here's Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina in 2012, saying he thought you shouldn't be promoted to Secretary of State.
Somebody has got to start paying a price around this place. I don't think she deserves to be promoted. There are a lot of qualified people in this country the president could pick, but I am dead set on making sure we don't promote anybody that was an essential player in the Benghazi debacle.
I'm wondering, did the public kind of drubbing that you received, it went on for months about Benghazi, did that turn you for a time into a liability for the Obama administration?
Carol, I don't think so, or the president wouldn't have named me national security advisor subsequently. I think it's important for people to remember that in the first instance, the information that I provided on those Sunday shows was drafted by the intelligence community, approved by the intelligence community as our best current understanding of what had happened. There was no effort to mislead, to lie, or to falsify it. And 8 congressional investigations that looked into this subsequently validated that. Senator Graham was among the most vociferous and I would think disingenuous of those who attacked me. But the fact of the matter is I'd provided the information that was what we had at the time. And had I altered it or sought to inject my own judgment, that would have been a reason to question my competence and my trustworthiness. But the fact is it did, in the hot house of a political campaign and a political season, result in my being pilloried personally for many, many months, arguably years. And I think, has says more in retrospect about those who were attacking me than about the information and the motivations of those who, like me, were trying to provide the information we had to the American people.
What do you think is the most urgent foreign policy issue facing the U.S. right now?
The threats we face externally are rather constant and not substantially changed. What has changed in recent years is that rather than the United States serving as a force for predictability and stability in the world, trying for the most part to advance our interests in cooperation with others and do so in a fashion that's not just serving the United States but serving a larger interest, we have leadership that is radically unpredictable and unstable and bearing, you know, no affiliation to the truth, undermining our alliances, elevating and lauding our adversaries and dictators. And we have sort of upended rational perceptions of what the United States is and what we stand for. And as a consequence, we are exporting instability and unpredictability. And when you add that to these constant threats and challenges, it's quite a toxic mix. Carol, that's how you get, you know, these impulsive decisions to withdraw our personnel from northern Syria and throw our alliance with the Kurds away. That's how you get the Taliban invited to Camp David on the eve of 9/11. And it's how you get planes in the air 10 minutes from bombing Iran and then called off. The system and the process has broken down, and it is broken down in deference to an erratic, unpredictable, and I think increasingly dangerous president.
Former National Security Advisor Susan Rice. Her new memoir is called Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Modern Sudan was once home to the powerful and wealthy African kingdoms of Nubia. In the West, much of what we know about Nubia comes from the work of archaeologists a century ago, who sometimes saw things through a colonial lens. Some museums are now addressing that. The World's Rupa Shenoy takes us to a new exhibit about Nubia at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. Some say it was the real-life Wakanda.
The exhibit is a maze of darkened rooms with spotlights on statues and sculptures. In one nook, an Egyptian stone woman sits, smiling. Curator Denise Doxey tells me she was carved in about 1950 BC.
She's wearing a long, heavy wig and a sheath dress and holding a lotus blossom.
The statue was put in a tomb in what is now Sudan, and that's where George Reisner found it in 1913. He was an archaeologist and also a curator at this museum.
He's considered the father of American Egyptology. As an archaeologist, he was really superb.
But he also got a lot wrong, Doxey says, in part because Reisner based his assumptions on history that was written by Egyptians. They were at war with Nubians for generations, and they tended to describe Nubians as barbarians.
He was a wonderful archaeologist, but he was not a forward-thinking man on social issues at all. So he brings his own racial biases, which happened to dovetail nicely with the Egyptians' image of the Nubians. And he causes him to completely misinterpret the site.
Reisner classifies the whole tomb as Egyptian, adding to the stature of their role in history. Even though, besides the statue of the stone woman, everything else in the tomb, pottery, jewelry, is distinctly Nubian.
He just couldn't believe that the Nubians did all this themselves.
He couldn't believe that the Nubians had ruled over southern Egypt for a time and brought the stone woman statue back to Nubia as a prize. But Doxy says that's what actually happened.
He had it completely backwards.
Doxy says Reisner contributed to a portrayal of Nubia as a conquered, marginalized culture, somehow less important than Egypt, and eventually mostly forgotten by scholars.
You know, museums are wary about doing exhibitions and having nobody come because they don't know what Nubia is. So it perpetuates this idea that nobody knows what Nubia is, and it helps to keep that imbalance that Egypt is somehow much more important.
But it's been clear for some time that Reisner got it wrong. French and Swiss teams did excavations in Sudan in the 1960s and discovered that the tomb Reisner found with the statue, it was part of a thriving Nubian metropolis at the center of a trading network that reached far into Africa.
It's a massive fortified city with suburbs outside and ports and industrial areas and temples. So it was actually a very powerful and important kingdom.
A kingdom that left behind what's in the Nubia exhibit today. Fine pottery that's eggshell thin, dipped in a distinctive translucent blue glaze. Gold jewelry and sculptures depicting animals like rams and lions. Items that are ahead of their time, evidence of an advanced culture. In a way, Nubia was sort of Wakanda before Wakanda was Wakanda.
You're telling me that the king of a third world country runs around in a bulletproof cat suit?
You'll remember Wakanda as the fictional, ultra-advanced African country in the movie Black Panther.
The Black Panther has been the protector of Wakanda for generations.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, who writes the Black Panther series for Marvel, has said he imagines Wakanda being pretty much where Nubia was. So you could say that Nubia was the real-life Wakanda.
Yes. Yes, I think so.
Nicole Aljo is director of Africana Studies at Northeastern University. In a video in the Nubia exhibit, she talks about Pauline Hopkins, an African-American novelist who, in 1903, wrote about a secret advanced society of superhumans in the Nubia region. The idea of Nubia as a symbol pops up again and again, Aljo says. Right now, there's a ballot measure in Boston to rename a historic spot Nubian Square. It's currently named for an early governor who signed laws that enabled the slave trade.
So Nubia is kind of representing a kind of royal African history that folks can use to challenge European and racist colonialist ideologies.
The Museum of Fine Arts has offered Boston sixth graders and their families free tickets to the Nubia exhibit. Aljo says that's especially meaningful because of an incident that happened in May, when the museum says its planning for the Nubia exhibit was already underway. Seventh grade students of color on a field trip said they were racially profiled, and guards and other visitors said racist things to them.
That story was so horrifying. The outreach that the MFA is doing is certainly impacted by that.
The museum apologized and said it was creating a new senior director of inclusion position. Doxy, the curator, says now, to some extent, that incident informs everything they do. They're acknowledging the failings of one of the museum's important figures, even though questioning history could be seen as a political stance in the current environment.
I think we're trying to redress past issues that skewed in favor of white people. And that doesn't, I don't think, mean that we want to completely throw George Reisner under a bus and say he was horrible. But, I mean, I think we have to be honest. He was a racist.
That story by the world's Roopa Shenoy. Protesters in Lebanon scored a major and quick victory this week. The country's prime minister, Saad Hariri, said he's resigning. The nonviolent protests began only 2 weeks ago, with demonstrators blocking roads and bringing daily life in parts of the country to a standstill. And so far, the movement has transcended Lebanese politics as usual. As Rebecca Collard reports, it's unclear where things go next.
Protesters in downtown Beirut ecstatic at the news that Prime Minister Saad Hariri is resigning. It's a real victory for their movement. But moments later, the crowd breaks into one of the most popular chants of these protests.
Killing anyone means everyone is everyone. It's appealing to the whole ruling class.
The day after Hariri resigns, Mohamed Mazloum is part of a smaller crowd of demonstrators in Beirut. He's a 21-year-old medical student. He says the whole leadership of Lebanon needs to go. In the square outside the parliament building, a woman on a megaphone encourages protesters to stay in the streets. The revolution is not over, she says. But nobody can really tell these protesters when to come and go, because nobody told them to come out to the streets in the first place.
It's spontaneous. Everything that's happening started in a spontaneous spark, if you want.
Usually protests in Lebanon are organized by a political faction or civil society groups. But this time is different. People joined spontaneous demonstrations 2 weeks ago. It started when the government announced new taxes. Thousands of people took to the streets. There was a lot of anger, but no flags of political factions. And that's not usual here.
I can tell you it's a leaderless movement till now.
Most of the protesters I've talked to say that's a good thing. The lack of a leader or an official list of demands means everyone feels like they have a place in this movement. That means people of all ages and religious and economic backgrounds. The word leader has almost become a dirty word here.
But a time will come when we will need a leader or some kind of organization.
But now that they've toppled the prime minister, what's next for Lebanon's revolutionaries?
I should read it in a crystal ball.
Salim Murad is part of a group of about 100 mostly young people blocking a main road in Beirut. Like many protesters here, Murad says he doesn't know what's next.
I have no idea.
People here tell me that Hariri's resignation was not enough. They want the whole sectarian-based political system gone.
I feel like what we gained yesterday by the resignation of the prime minister and the government is only 5%.
At the end of Lebanon's civil war in 1990, Lebanon reestablished its sectarian-based power-sharing system, with each religious group getting a specific government position. The prime minister is always a Sunni Muslim, the president a Christian, and the speaker of the house a Shia Muslim. Protesters say that system is broken and that it's brought mismanagement and corruption, allowing politicians to embezzle billions of dollars. Demonstrators are calling for a new government of technocrats. They want experts and capable politicians to take over.
At least if there's a new government with new people, technocrats, that decide when the new soon elections of the parliament will be.
The gap between rich and poor here is massive. Around one-third of Lebanese live below the poverty line, while government ministers roll through the streets in convoys of shiny new armored SUVs. Murad says these protests are about changing all that.
We want everything. We want a Lebanon that we dream of, with no corruption in the government and parliament and the presidency and everything. People that resembles us, the people, and the things that we want, to fight corruption, to make it less polluted, to bring back the money that was robbed from the people.
Experts say Lebanon's economy is at a breaking point, and they warn of a complete economic collapse. Back at the parliament building, Mohamed Mazloum repeats the call for a government of experts.
So we want a new prime minister who is able to form a new technocrat government that could save us from collapse.
But he says he knows that getting there will be a struggle.
We still have a long way to a real revolution.
That was apparent this week when supporters of the powerful Hezbollah and Amal movements fought with the protesters, testing their unity and resolve. And that resolve is likely to be tested again on the long path to political change. For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard in Beirut.
Boo.
Today is Halloween. The pressure to have the perfect costume can be intense. But a group in Tokyo has turned that notion on its head. The World's Jessica Yarmosky has the story.
Halloween in Tokyo is known to be over the top. The streets fill with thousands of people dressed to the nines in elaborate costumes. Walk through Tokyo's Shibuya neighborhood and you'll see mummies on stilts, a lifelike Batman, and lots of princesses. And I mean princesses with formal ball gowns. That's Halloween footage from media company Tokyo Fashion.
But there's a small group of people in Shibuya that has completely rejected the notion of an over-the-top Halloween. Instead, they do the opposite. The far, far opposite. And dress up as the most boring things they can think of. The tradition of Jimmy Halloween, which translates to mundane Halloween, was started in 2014 by entertainment company Daily Portal Z. They say a small group of adults wanted to get into the Halloween spirit, but felt awkward going too all out. So they turned to totally banal costumes. Now, hundreds show up for Daily Portal Z's annual event, where they step on stage to explain their costumes to two MCs, like this guy. He's wearing totally normal clothes, with a rolled-up tissue shoved up one of his nostrils and a smattering of fake blood on his shoulder. He went as guy who got a nosebleed in his sleep, which worried his mom, so he took medicine. Then there's a couple that went to Disneyland but got into an argument, so now it's kind of awkward between them. And here's another one good for two people. One girl carries a shopping basket and walks ahead of her friend, who has an armful of groceries. Their costume? Girls who went shopping on the way home from work and meant to get one thing but ended up getting a lot more. Naturally. Now, if you don't quite understand someone's costume at first glance, that's okay. Just look at the labels hanging around everyone's necks that explain who exactly they're supposed to be. And if you don't have a Halloween costume yet, no worries. Grab an empty Amazon box, ruffle up your hair, and go as person who was woken up in the middle of the night by an Amazon delivery. I'm sure the guy in Tokyo who actually did that won't mind you borrowing his idea. For the world, I'm Jessica Yarmosky.
Count me inspired. I'm dressing up as a public radio host tonight. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Have a happy Halloween.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.